This is Walter Dennis. I'd like to ask you something. What would America's founding fathers have done if they knew that someday a black man would be president of the United States? Our first president, George Washington, and many of his compatriots owned thousands of Negro slaves. Others, such as Thomas Jefferson, tried deporting America's black population to a West African state still known as Liberia. He wrote into the U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 2, that a Negro shall be considered only 3/5 of a person, a non-citizen, unable to vote. Today, if you travel to our nation's capital, you'll read the following words inscribed in stone on the Jefferson Memorial. Quote, "Nothing is more certainly written in the book of fate than that these people, the Negroes, are to be free." Unquote. Thomas Jefferson's statement is allowed to end there, leaving visitors with the impression that our third president was a liberal integrationist. But this quotation from his autobiography has been taken out of its original context. Someone has selectively deleted the rest of Jefferson's words, which are, quote, "Nor is it less certain that the two races, equally free, cannot live in the same government. Nature, habit, opinion have drawn indelible lines of distinction between them." Unquote. But what about Abraham Lincoln? He freed the slaves, so he must have loved them. Liberals like to imagine that by calling upon his memory, they lend authority to their racially integrated agendas. But this is what Lincoln said during his fourth presidential debate on September 18, 1858. Quote, "I will say then that I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of bringing about in any way the social and political equality of the black and white races. That I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of making voters or jurors of Negroes, nor of qualifying them to hold office, nor to intermarry with white people. And I will say, in addition to this, that there is a physical difference between the black and white races which will ever forbid the two races living together on terms of social and political equality. And inasmuch as they cannot so live, while they do remain together, there must be the position of superior and inferior. And I, as much as any other man, am in favor of having the superior position assigned to the white race." Unquote. Today, any politician running for public office, in fact, anyone making such a statement, would be loudly condemned as a racist of the worst possible kind, expelled from school or fired from his job, and arrested on charges of committing a hate crime. Yet, Lincoln, Jefferson, and Washington are supposed to be our country's great icons. No teacher, no one in the news or entertainment media will ever tell you what these men actually believed about so-called Afro-Americans. Nor will they tell you that blacks are responsible for more than 80% of violent crimes committed in our country, even though Negroes make up just 12% of its population. That must come as a shock to regular viewers of television, where blacks are around half the faces seen on the tube. Unlike their real-life versions, televised blacks are almost invariably portrayed as pitiful victims of injustice at the hands of white bigots, or lovable heroes deserving our adoration and emulation. This is because television is nothing more than a backed-up toilet overflowing with lies. It is a font of poison floating with stinking falsehoods in which truth dies and sinks. Beginning after the turn of the last century, race-mixing propagandists have taken particular delight in elevating half-breeds to superstar status. Television personalities and political celebrities of black and white parentage are more often placed upon the highest public pedestals for special homage. At the same time, no opportunity is missed to promote racially mixed unions, typically of a blonde white woman to a blue-black male, together with the couple's half-breed offspring, which invariably take after their African father. When we look around the world at racially mixed countries, we find such exotic lands as India, Morocco, and Mexico. These places are human garbage dumps, characterized by squalor, violence, starvation, filth, and disease on a colossal scale of hopeless misery. They were not always so. 4,000 years ago, a civilization of clean-swept boulevards and magnificent public baths flourished throughout the Indus Valley. 2,000 years later, Morocco was set with marble temples and gleaming health spas, a jewel in the crown of the Roman Empire. 500 years ago, conquistadors from Spain raised a prosperous colony upon the ruins of Aztec Indian human sacrifice and cannibalism. All of these formerly high cultures in Mexico, Morocco, and India were created exclusively by white civilizers. While colored natives may have supplied some of the labor, civilization was the product of white genius. So long as the white master builders preserved their dominance and racial integrity, society functioned as intended. But as they interbred with Negroes and other lowlife, white identity drowned in a raceless morass of darkening generations that bore less and less resemblance to their fair-skinned founding fathers. Their originally high intelligence level sank into an increasingly dumber and savage population. The once splendid civilizations of the Indus Valley, Central America, and North Africa decayed into the rotting urban centers now known as New Delhi, Tijuana, or Marrakesh. America stands in the same shadow that eventually reduced these formerly civilized centers to subhuman cesspools. Such putrid places graphically represent the goal set for our country by fanatic integrationists who embrace race mixing with all the fervor of religious extremists. Their aim is to reduce the United States to another Bangladesh or Sudan. The mass murderers of our posterity flaunt their sympathy for the colored downtrodden of this world in order to parade what they imagine is a kind of moral superiority over everyone else. These people are truly insane. Their real core motivation is a psychopathic loathing for everything and everyone white. That only can explain such hysterical intolerance of the slightest criticism for the race-mixed utopia they demand. They cannot work fast enough for the eventual extirpation of the white race through wholesale interbreeding with Congoid apes. Their aim is the dissolution of all the world's races into a single global souffle of genetic excrement. And anyone who raises an objection to their high-minded nightmare is condemned and ostracized as a racist, an enemy to what is ever fair and good. Yet, what we take for granted today as civilization is the exclusive product of white men and women. From computers and hair curlers to bicycles and space shuttles, everything we know as modern technology was brought about entirely by white inventors. It stands to reason that when their kind no longer exists, their creations will disintegrate, just like old American cars falling apart in the littered streets of Mexico City. While white people were building great civilizations around the world for the last 5,000 years, blacks in Africa never figured out how to make a wheel. They never built anything more substantial than a mud hut. They knew nothing about metal, glass, or tool. They never had a written language. Their technology did not extend beyond the tip of their wood spears. Their only medicine was voodoo. They never sailed on anything greater than a floating log, even though they resided along thousands of miles of coastline. And all this centuries before they could claim slavery as an excuse for their utter lack of know-how. They never put one stone upon another, thought of a light bulb, invented an airplane, designed a fountain pen, wrote a poem, painted a portrait, or initiated anything associated with civilized life. Although Afro-Americans have come to benefit from these things and more, they created none of them. They have always excelled, however, in those activities which characterize them best: violent behavior and monumental squalor. For proof, drive through the south side of Chicago, into Gary, Indiana, or black streets in any metropolitan area, if you dare. There you will see old, rotting buildings tottering above gang-infested sinkholes of urban filth. These are the ruins of white civilization, microcosms for what the rest of America is becoming. This national decay translates itself into escalating murders, assaults, rapes, robberies, and a virtual tidal wave of atrocities committed daily against white men, women, and children. Considered more important than their own self-defense, They are cautioned against racism when identifying their dark assailants, because followers of the race-mixing dogma are indifferent to these white victims. Outsiders rarely learn of their fate. They are not showcased on television, nor featured on the front page of a major newspaper. For example, a few years ago, charges were leveled against Duke University students accused of gang raping an innocent black girl. Months before the high-profile case collapsed because their ultra-liberal prosecutor was disbarred for falsifying the evidence against them, and the accuser herself turned out to be a lying half-wit, they were tried and found guilty by every major American newspaper and television network. The young white men were simultaneously and universally castigated as racists of the most awful type, meriting the severest punishment. Reverends Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson made daily telecasts deploring the climate of intolerance and sick racism that pervades our country. FBI spokesmen speculated that the alleged gang rape was a hate crime. Social services liberals swung into action to provide counseling and financial assistance for the bogus black victim and her family. While the falsely accused white students were being vilified across the nation week after week, Americans were pointedly not informed of another, this time authentic atrocity that was absolutely boycotted, deliberately ignored, hushed up, even censored from public knowledge. In a successful effort to contain all outside awareness of the story, no network anchorman or mainstream reporter announced the arrest in Kentucky of four black men and one black female for perpetrating some of the most ghastly crimes ever committed in U.S. history. They were accused of abducting and murdering a young white couple. While his girlfriend looked on, they castrated Christopher Newsom, 24, then burned him alive and fired several shots into him. Over the next several days, the satanic savages beat and raped his girlfriend, Shannon Christian, 23, and took turns urinating on her. On the fourth day, they cut off her breasts, stuffed a large variety of toxic chemicals, including floor cleaner, into her mouth, then slowly stabbed her to death. Not a word about this unspeakable crime was heard on the nightly news, because NBC, CBS, CNN, ABC, Fox, and all the rest of the alphabetical deceivers were obsessed at the time with the phony Duke University rape case. There was no appeal to the sensitivities of millions of regular viewers. No social services liberals thought to comfort the families of the white victims. The torture and murder of two young white people by five blacks is not a hate crime in the FBI's book, and Reverends Sharpton and Jackson had nothing to say. Their silence is part of the deliberate censorship of any information harmful to the artificial, false image of blacks perpetrated by America's news media masters. They realize that such censorship of the truth is vital to their race-mixing agenda. Yet we are invited to embrace these killer gorillas as our equals, no, as our physical, moral, and intellectual superiors. What then can we expect for the future? Unchecked, the forces of decline will climax in mid-century. Given the continuous and accelerating inundation of the United States by waves of immigrants from south of the border, Africa, Asia, India, and the Middle East, our continent's white population will have slipped to minority status before 2050. By then, our race will have become so polluted through interbreeding with subhumans, its identity will be progressively marginalized until it no longer exists. The next 40 years will also witness America's inevitable economic conquest by Red China and India, the very countries past U.S. presidents were so anxious to assist. Our standard of living will plummet to levels comparable with Ecuador or Somalia. Companies and businesses here will be largely Asian-owned, and Americans will have to work for mostly colored bosses. The U.S. dollar will eventually become so weak it must be replaced by some international currency. With health care largely in the hands of physicians from Pakistan or the Philippines, medical help will be rendered virtually useless, and certainly unable to keep pace with too many viral strains introduced by the endless deluge of germ-carrying colored immigrants. As in any fundamental social dislocation, a tsunami of criminal bloodshed will sweep across North America. Since white people by then will have been disarmed by gun control fanatics, their spirit of resistance diluted by decades of instilled health self-hatred, and all police forces predominantly black and brown, pale-faced victims can expect little protection and less mercy. They will suffer the same kind of massacres carried out in the past against hapless whites by Indian savages on the American plains. By then, the Bill of Rights promised that, quote, the right of the people to bear arms, unquote, will have been wiped away by the enemies of white America. One of its most prominent founders, Thomas Jefferson, insisted that, quote, no free man shall ever be debarred the use of arms against tyranny in government. The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants, unquote. In the years to come, only ruins and garbage will be left to show that the world was once inhabited by temporarily civilized but ultimately self-destructive human beings. Sounds like a rather bleak scenario for the future. That certainly is what the evangelists of race mixing want us to believe. Things have gone too far for some white Americans. They have given up without a fight, resigned themselves and their posterity to defeat and oblivion. They point out the shameful fact that a black man, worse, a mongrel half-breed, is now President of the United States. It was not the combined support of Negroes and Hispanics that won the election for him. Their endorsement could have been expected. No, he was voluntarily installed in the White House by a solid majority of white voters, the same people being exterminated by the very elements he himself personally embodies. More than 65 years ago, Adolf Hitler warned U.S. servicemen during World War II that their taking up arms against his racially aware country would inevitably backfire on them by putting a Negro in the White House. They laughed at him. The vast majority of white Americans in the 1940s regarded blacks then as little more than subhuman clowns, hardly worthy of attention. The very notion of a black-faced president had more in common with a comedy skit than anything in the foreseeable future. Yet, some of those Second World War veterans who once thought Hitler's prediction so amusing are no longer laughing. A colored chief executive was unthinkable, ludicrous even, until the early 1970s, when big city mayoral positions and state governorships were first occupied by Negroes. If a black mayor, some argued, why not a black president someday? Coincidental with the blacks advancing political power, all mainstream avenues of public information joined at every level of education to wring the last ounce of racial self-respect from our people. They were psychologically conditioned to embrace every manifestation of racial suicide in a comprehensive campaign as ubiquitous as it was relentless. A two-prong attack morally undercut white Americans by stressing their original sin of racism while constantly heroizing blacks as altogether superior, lovable creatures. Only decades of unrelieved and concerted propaganda made a Negro president possible. Without this incessant programming, such an incomparable disgrace would never have come to pass. Blacks are self-evidently too dim-witted to have achieved anything on their own. They represent merely a means to an end, namely the lethal pollution of our race. Once a white people have been poisoned by interbreeding, they disappear forever from the face of the earth, never to return. The original white builders of Egypt, Iran, Persia, India, and all the other lands that so long ago flourished, utterly vanished. Their formerly vibrant cultures reduced to dead ruins when they renounced the irreplaceable heritage of their pure blood. Racially weakened, their societies were beset by uncontrollable criminal violence, moral rot, economic collapse, political corruption, and cultural decay, until foreigners obliterated them. As the historian Will Durant warned us during the last century, quote, a great civilization is not conquered from without until it has destroyed itself from within. Unquote. America is not exempt from that iron law, with Red China poised to take over from the United States as the next superpower. Accordingly, the U.S. seems doomed to repeat the same kind of suicide committed by past civilizations, and nothing can be done to stop it so long as the majority of Americans are either indifferent to their country's fate or actually aiding and abetting it. So, what are you going to do? Let it go? Will you allow yourself to be pushed into the background and told to shut up, afraid to raise your voice in a feeble word of protest? Isn't there anything you can do that really matters? There is, and it has nothing whatsoever to do with complaining to your congressman, signing petitions, or writing to a newspaper editor. Your enemies brush aside such obsolete methods with a contemptuous laugh. The very first thing you have got to do is get mad. No one can do anything really meaningful unless they're consumed with justifiable anger. God knows you have more to be enraged about than you can even imagine. But you know enough about white kids beaten by Afro-American gangsters. You know enough about white women raped and tortured by black monsters. You know enough about the anti-white lies you're supposed to swallow in silence. You've got to get up and shout in the face of your enemy, "I'm a white American, damn it, and I'm not going to take your race-mixing crap anymore!" The psychotic Negrophiles are quick to denounce and label anyone who fails to embrace their savage yahoos as haters. But if you cannot hate someone who threatens your own loved ones with suffering and death, you're a failure as a human being. Anyone who won't defend those they love for fear of giving offense is a worthless coward. We can and will no longer be silenced by the race-mixing bullies pushing our world towards extinction. We will no longer be made ashamed of being white while others insist on black pride. We will not allow ourselves to be weakened by all those numerous, relatively petty differences that divide white men and keep us from forming a united front against the haters of our betrayed people. Those differences, how otherwise significant they may seem, must be put aside and not allowed to deflect one degree from our unity as white men and women. We must draw our wagons into a circle, close up our ranks in an unbreakable flank. Political, religious, class, ideological, or any of the other sorts of differences that threaten to divide our racial solidarity must be avoided. All that counts now is our self-awareness as white men and women. And anyone who attempts to detract one ounce from our racial unity has joined the enemies of white America. That the majority hates us or simply doesn't care about the survival of white America means nothing. When George Washington and his fellow revolutionaries took on the British Empire, the most powerful machine of its kind on earth, they were opposed by a solid majority of their own countrymen. Most people couldn't have cared less one way or the other. More than a third of Americans hated the Patriots, who were supported by just 15% of the colonial population. And from that small minority, only a fractional percentage actually participated in the war for independence. Yet, these few activists, against the will of a pro-British majority, themselves embodied a majority of willpower and energy to expel powerful invaders from our country. The American patriots who achieved this miracle were not liberals. They did not love their enemies. They were proud to be robust haters of the foreigners who imposed a frightful tyranny on the United States. The same situation confronts us today. Most white Americans are indifferent to the present decline and future destruction of their own race. To them, the only things that matter are making money and wasting their lives watching television. A majority of our fellow countrymen and women have been reduced to brainwashed lemmings, but not all of them. National election results for the past few years, where race-conscious candidates have run for office, have conclusively shown that 15% of our people understand and loathe the anti-white haters who have pushed us to the brink of extinction. That doesn't sound like much, but 15% of the U.S. population fleshes out into 37 million race-conscious white Americans. Within those 37 millions lies a 3% minority of 75,000 potential activists, a veritable army of warriors. The chief task of the anti-white establishment has always been to drive a wedge between the 37 million white people who have not yet lost their souls to race mixing and the 75,000 fighters who can lead them to victory over the corruptors of our racial integrity. Anyone who can appreciate the high significance of these percentages understands at once that he or she is not an isolated individual, a freak for refusing to embrace the race-mixed propaganda of our times, unlike most everyone else. On the contrary, there are millions and millions of white Americans just as inwardly disgusted and repelled by the colored pollution of our people as we are ourselves. These numbers may encourage us, but our resistance must not depend on them. If the spirits of America's proudly racist founding fathers could return to see how we, their descendants, have allowed the liberty they fought and died for to have been stolen by repulsive fugitives from the African jungle, they would command us as Patrick Henry did. "We must fight," he said. Listen to these words he spoke more than 200 years ago. Quote, "I repeat it, sir, we must fight. An appeal to arms and the God of hosts is all that is left to us. Should I keep back my opinions at such a time through fear of giving offense, I should consider myself as guilty of treason toward my country. Why stand we here idle? What is it that the gentlemen wish? What would they have? Is life so dear, or peace so sweet, as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death." Unquote. That is the real American spirit that defied all the powers of hell and stood up to the hostile majority and won. It is a spirit no longer seen in our fellow countrymen because they have been lulled to sleep by the criminal conspirators against our lives, our liberty, and our posterity. How many more of our friends and family have to be mugged by black or Hispanic cowardly punks before you're mad enough to fight? How many more white kids are you going to allow to be beaten by colored gangbangers? How many more formerly white women must mate with darksome subhumans and bear their degraded offspring before our race is bred out of existence? For God's sake, man, get some guts! If you think things are bad now, just wait until 2040, when white people slip to minority status in the U.S. We've already become a minority in the American Southwest, and in major cities such as Chicago, where the white residents have been reduced to just one quarter of the total population, with a resultant spike in violent crime across the Windy City. Today, white people are already outnumbered by 8-to-1 odds on Earth. The American countdown has begun. Every 29 seconds, another illegal alien penetrates the United States. Every 10 minutes, another poisonous half-breed is spawned inside our borders. These hard facts embody the harsh truth about the real condition of our country. Get this through your head. America is threatened with death. Our struggle is for nothing less than our survival. Nothing in our lives is more important. No sacrifice we can make on its behalf too great. This struggle also ennobles us, however. It provides anyone who personally champions its cause the highest self-respect because it embodies the brightest truth in this age of lies. The truth, hidden or knocked to the ground, always rises again to reveal itself. But it is not enough to see through the anti-white bias of our day. In itself, the most magnificent sword is no more than an inanimate object until someone has the courage to grasp it firmly by the handle and wield it against his enemies. So, too, a hidden truth is worthless until it is unsheathed and used to boldly cut down all liars. Patrick Henry and his fellow patriots knew the hard truth of their times and were brave enough to raise it in defense of liberty. They were not black or Latino or Jewish or octoroon, such as that racial anomaly in the White House. His installation is only a benchmark in the death of the United States. More significantly, however, it is a national wake-up call that remaining 15% of white Americans get aware of their own racial identity, can hear and understand. It means that the hour for their survival is very late. The alarm is blaring with terrible urgency. Let that same signal also reignite the revolutionary spark of our white forefathers. Let it catch your own soul on fire and spread its flames across our betrayed nation. Some 65 years ago, a nameless hero, long among millions of warriors, declared, quote, "In times of gravest danger, the soul of our people erupts with elemental force to fend off all mortal blows and to assert itself. The soul's energy proves itself stronger than any numerical or material superiority. General readiness escalates to the highest action. What does his life mean to the individual if the sacred life of his race is threatened? He sacrifices himself so that that greater life is won. Superhuman feats are performed, and the word impossible is no longer known." Unquote. White America isn't dead yet. On the contrary, the sleeping giant is stirring from his propaganda-induced trance. And when he fully awakens, the puny enemies and congenital liars that scheme to kill him in his sleep will scatter like diseased vermin at the sight of his all-consuming rage. On your feet, white man! Stand up and fight!
I like to play that every few weeks because that's very important for you to understand, for everybody to understand that everybody's got to do their bit. Doesn't have to be monumental, but they got to do their bit. That's why I think it's important to get this non-equal sign out. And if you don't have the money, I'll send you a few. But paste them up on an 8.5 by 11 or 8.5 by 14, and run copies, and then get a cutter and cut them. And I mean, put them everywhere. Get on top of a building and let them fly, hundreds. There needs to be a symbol that people can agree on to get behind. And that's one symbol I found that if anybody's at least bit racial, can get behind it. The other symbols have too much baggage. No matter how wonderful you think they were, they've got too much baggage. Too much argument, too much of that. This symbol, and I don't even have to put any wording or where to write to or anything on it. This symbol tells it all. I've been personally putting out hundreds of them. You get these prepaid envelopes out of the mail. You get a lot of them. I know I do. Or you go down to the post office and just go into the trash cans and pull them out. They're not going to give you any trouble for doing that. Take them home and paste these or put these symbols inside the envelope and send them off. But it's going to take a lot more going out than I'm able to do by myself. But if there's going to be a rallying point for this struggle, it's got to have some kind of a symbol. And also, that symbol can be simply carrying a felt pen in your pocket when you're around town, and wherever you see a place where you think it ought to be, you do it. Especially on other political opponents' picture boards and advertising and so forth. So if you carry that felt pen around, it's almost as good. In fact, it's just as good as the decal. But we need to do it. You know, Trump, no matter how serious he is raising the issues to the boiling point. And if there's any time to get the attention to a lot of dumbed-down American whites, it's now, in the next year before this election. Because it's going to get fever hot. And you'll want the press to start zeroing in on that non-equal symbol and go from there. So anyhow, this is Terrible Tommy, and I'm back in the bunker here on Moon's Day. Beautiful day here in north central Indiana. sun shining. Yeah, leaves are beautiful. It's so beautiful. I've been taking pictures of a lot of these trees, golden and red and all kinds of colors. This is a beautiful time of the year. And, you know, it represents something, you know, that things have to die somewhat. They never really die. Isn't that a little bit like the race? We show signs of dying all over the place, but we're not really dying. We're not to that point yet. Yeah, I like that. Fall is a good time. And we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And that's where you send your donations for the radio show, donations for anything else you want to send to us. And then go up to resist.com and get smart. Not the TV show with the Jew back in the 60s or 70s. Maxwell Smart, yeah. He had secret telephones in his shoes and all that kind of stuff. I never watched it because it was so hokey and corny that, and I like corny, but that Jew just turned me off. Well, I got a nice letter from David Tate, POW, order man, youngest guy in the order. Dear Tom, received $25 from you on my account a few weeks ago, about the same time I also got a letter from you. Thanks. I've been very busy with multiple projects, one which has only just been sent to a sister in Australia is enclosed. A fresh interview I thought I would share with you. It was a struggle to answer, both because of the time, but also because it seemed a mental climb uphill. I'm a slow and wordy writer as it is, so I'll be interested in your thoughts on this one. I have no news to speak of, so I'll print out a few paragraphs I have in memory, one to other prisoners on recent changes in conditions here, and another on a book I'm editing correcting some Christian identity positions. Since I was once identity, I feel free to have my say, although it may not be your subject. Well, at least he's got partially out. I imagine he still thinks he's a Christian, but I think he'll gradually get totally out. But that's just my opinion. I've gotten no reply from Eric Rudolph, but we've sent a couple of checks or money orders to. So I'm not sure what's going on there. This place has gone to poop since we got a new major from Potosi, a real shit camp. They started the step-up level phases, crap coming out of the hole now, moved all honor wings to both ends of the camp, stranding something like 40 honor wing inmates in the GP houses, turned four houses where I am, in a GP house, and five houses into a shit house where they have put all the troublemakers and anyone with guard assaults. A GP house in these level 5 camps is locked in a cell 20 hours a day. And Tommy would say that's cruel and unusual punishment, even if you did give a guard a bloody nose. That's inhuman. I don't go to the zoos anymore. You may think I'm crazy, but Terrible Tommy has lost his taste for seeing people and animals in cages. I remember when I lived in Florida when I was a little kid for a year or so, somebody gave me a fox, wild fox, and I had a pen for him, and he just kept prancing back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And I knew he was miserable, so I let him go. We're losing half of our rec because they're running everything late or locking us down for BS. Now, this is a report I get from all the prisons. Any least little thing, they'll lock the prisoners down. It cuts down on their workload. We've had two major shakedowns in the past 3 months. The second, conducted by assholes they brought from Potosi and Farmington. Apparently, they really souped up these cops before they came in. I expect them to wreck our cells. But those punks went the extra mile, spraying baby powder all over our desk, lotion into my cell. Just a minute, I got a neck brace on, I'm going to take it off. All over the desk, lotion into my cellie's laundry, setting both our clocks back 15 minutes. I guess they thought we'd miscount. And even smashing up a cherry pie I had into mush. This is how petty these damn guards become in these prisons. And believe me, it'll happen to anybody that goes to work that has power over prisoners. Scientifically, it's been proven over and over. Almost all of them turn into beasts. The guys down there at Guantanamo, that's another subject. I wish Castro would kick the U.S. out of Guantanamo and make them close that thing down. They lock up I don't know how many people for BS contraband, not keeping our head on the wall or talking while they were wrecking our stuff. They confiscate contraband from every cell and literally hand out CDVs to half of the inmates who had contraband. Things like old sunglasses, gloves, and whatnot old heads had from the old days while they finished up our cell. I suspect most of these people see themselves as purveyors of justice and Christians and go to some Judeo church or another. May God in heaven treat them with equal fairness in their lives. Well, they're going to have to get it on earth, because waiting for God in heaven to do it someday is a waste of time. I'm not sure how long this insanity will last, but expect it will continue to get worse until this major or warden leaves. Remember, these warden jobs are political jobs. If they support the right party, they get appointed to be a warden, which rumor has it may be next year he may leave. I've seen things change so often in this system over the years that I expect bad to happen. But some of this stuff has actually caught me by surprise. One of the things that got in the way of answering my mail was a book draft I was editing on the Israelite migration myths by Jacob Inn and Pastor Harrell. The Israelite migration myths were fabricated in the 16th century when Cromwell, the so-called architect of English Reformation, brought the Jews back to England. Yeah, they brought them back from Holland to ease the return of the previously banished Jews. The Antichrist kite lovers claimed that the British were the so-called lost 10 tribes of Israel, and hence kindred to the Jews, who called the tribe of Judah. Over time, this doctrine grew into British Israelitism, which later led to odd offshoots such as Armstrongism here in America. Armstrong posed that Britain and America were the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh, the Jews and Judah, but the evil Germans descended as the evil Assyrians. I studied all this. I've got the books on my shelf of this evolution of this myth of British Israelism and how it infected the very crown in Israel, I mean in England, and the Jews were laughing up their ass at the way they've been manipulating the white race ever since. One of the problems is once it got over here and it got the Covenant peoples were up there in Canada, I visited all these headquarters, so I know what goes on. And then it dropped down in the United States, and all these preachers picked it up. They were well-meaning preachers like Butler and Colonel William Gale and Bertrand L. Compere from San Diego, and I forget the one from Massachusetts had it for a long time, and a whole raft of them, and there were spinoffs from all these people. since I was involved years ago. But I believe the major spinoff in this country was to take it that they tried to make before it was the Germans were bad people. It was all the Germans' fault. And they represented the Assyrians and they were evil and satanic. But then in this country, I think it was under Henry Ford's leadership that it took a turn the other way, and the Germans were okay. And they went back to just being the Jew problem. And that's the way it's been ever since. Well, that's fine. There is a Jew problem. And there sure is a hell of a lot of unscrupulous, Zionist, money-grubbing, greedy Jews. There's no doubt about that. And I often ask myself, why would I want to believe in something that says I'm a Jew too? You know, then the identity people think that, you know, they keep preaching they're the real Hebrews and all that kind of stuff, which is sort of an insult, really. And when I was in Japan, I found out that there were Japanese Israelites too, where there was a sizable number of people there believed they were Jews. Everybody all over the world has had a few people that claim to be these Jews. Why would you want to be connected with such a lousy bunch of people, collectively a lousy bunch of people? I'm not saying that every Jew I've ever met was a lousy Jew, but a lousy person, but there's a hell of a lot of crap comes out of their little game, and it's built on, primarily it's built on religion, the Abrahamic religion. And that's the three: Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. If we could get those three out of the way, which is going to take 500 years probably, if at all, things would smooth out quite a bit in the world. But as long as they're moving forward and recruiting more and more people, and I just heard a guy say that he was sending thousands of audio Bibles to India. Well, they're screwed up enough with all their different religions and worshiping the cow and everything else. Now to add Christianity into it, that just causes more trouble. There's bloodbaths over there all the time between these different religions. And so here comes Christians, to, just like they've done in the Middle East. They pushed in there with Christianity, and they already had one psycho religion. This just makes it worse. And then of course, the Christians here say, oh my God, they killed a Christian. They don't say a white person. It's always, they killed a Christian, no matter what color it is. And then those people become so-called Christians over there, and they come over here, and then they attack other countries and other people from over here, and use propaganda against good people over there. So, I mean, you know, it's a rotten situation. No matter how you look at it, baby, they're whack jobs. Well, David goes on to say pretty much what I've said. In the early to mid-1900s, far-right preachers in America twisted the theory again to produce Israel identity by reformatting the twisted facts and slanting the history of the British Israelis. Identity reformatted the migration myth to include all European nations as the tribes of Israel, making Germany Judah and properly identifying the modern Jews as mongrel imposters and or the literal seed line of Satan, depending upon which branch you're looking at. Well, I don't know. When I look around the world today, David, I read what it said about Satan in the Bible, he sounded like a moderate to what we've got today. Unfortunately, over time, identity has gathered a mishmash of denominational positions that do not clash with, not only clash with one another, but which are generally derived piecemeal from Judeo so-called Christian doctrines that were often designed to subvert the primitive Adamic Christianity, Adamic equal Aryan. Basically, every new preacher to join the identity over the past century has failed to leave their Jewish Judeo-Christian baggage at the door and has dragged many false doctrines which were originally designed to pander the Jews into identity. And so identity has remained divided into dozens of schools of thoughts, many of which are not properly scriptural. It's not that the most identity folks aren't right in principle on many issues. They identify the Adamic Aryan race as the race of God. They preach that the race mixing is a sin and that Jews are mongrel imposters, all of which is true. But they fail to fully understand the new covenant in... I'm not going to finish this up because I know what you're thinking. It's more of the mishmash. He's still, even though he's a good man, he's still got one foot in this Christian stuff. And I haven't sent him anti-arguments thus far because I didn't want to interrupt our friendship. But I'm afraid from here on in, now that he's gotten out of one thing, I'm going to start sending him other stuff to read. Because he needs to get out of this thing altogether, because it's just going to worry him, and he's going to spend all kinds of time, and he may write a book about it, and it'll all be for naught. We've got one simple answer, whether the white race lives or the white race dies. I think I told you before, somebody asked me why we didn't have David Tate's name on our website. Once in a while, a prisoner will tell me, I get too much mail, I can't answer it all, and so please take my name off the list. And that's what David Tate doesn't mean he's upset with us. And other activity here, I got paperwork from the attorneys for Dennis Mahan, and they're appealing to the Supreme Court. I haven't read this all. These things are hard to read, you know, that legalese stuff. Motion to stay ruling on petition for panel and in-bank rehearing pending Supreme Court decision in Taylor versus United States. So they send me pages and pages of this stuff, and it's pretty much gobbledygook unless you're an attorney. But I hope for the best. I hope at least they get his sentence reduced, but I don't think they will. I don't think there's a chance in hell of that. Most of his argument has been on his lawyer's argument, who's done a good job, actually. Most of his argument has been on the Interstate Commerce Clause. And I don't have time to go into all that, but one thing to remember is one of the things that really legally make this country, the so-called United States, is the Interstate Commerce Clause, and it's all about business. And they use the Interstate Commerce Clause to charge almost anybody that does anything out of the ordinary. Recently, we've had these gun laws, and some people are getting around them by starting a company inside a state, and they don't export out of the state. And I don't know how that's going, but I think they've so far been able... I don't know where that's at... where that company's at, but they get around the Interstate Commerce Clause. And of course, anybody that goes on the run, what brings the FBI into the case is interstate commerce. They use the interstate commerce laws. They may use a lot of other nonsense now, but basically, when I think John Dillinger and those guys were running around, I think they had the Interstate Commerce Clause, and they used that against them. So if you go on the run and you cross the state lines, then it becomes federal, interstate commerce. One of the worst things we ever did as far as division and tribalism and so forth and separation of state powers was the Interstate Commerce Commission, and sooner or later it should be destroyed. It must be destroyed at some point. But we'll have to wait till this government gets a hell of a lot weaker than it is before that's going to happen. The states are going to have to get up onto the hind legs and fight. But the trouble is the legislatures at the state level are as bad or worse than the federal level. and even worse, they're ignorant, stupid. Some of these people in the Bible Belt that are in positions of power in these states, and I've got them right here in Indiana, are crazy. I mean, they're uneducated. I mean, they're educated in the wrong way, and not anything good comes out of them because, look, the masses in the Bible Belt are dumb, especially on religion. And so they vote for these guys. The guy, preacher becomes a senator or whatever. And so to ever get anything really going in the states, that's going to be a hell of a job, almost as hard as getting something going against the feds. Here's a letter from Dennis Mahon I just recently got. Dear Tom, I hope everything is going well for you and Mary and Rebel, your dog, if he is still alive. I'm glad this very hot weather is finally past and the cooler temps are finally here. I can see the trees on the hills around the prison are finally turning beautiful orange and yellows. Enclosed is a letter from my Japanese Tokyo University professor, pen pal, Kenji Abe. That brings a bell. I think I might have had contact with him when I was in Japan. We have been in contact with each other for over 2 years. He wants to visit me and interview me about white separatism and nationalism. I believe over a year ago I gave him your address, but I don't remember if you ever contacted him or he ever contacted you. Anyway, I'm sure he would love to hear what you have to say on many subjects. Anyway, I have not gotten a letter from you in quite a spell. The Brewston Mills, Virginia Post Office, or the prison mail, seem to be destroying or stealing or delaying, losing my mail, as they get less than half of my personal mail from the few family and friends that write me since coming to Hazleton FCI. They will never stop their hatred and persecution of me. I am pretty much used to it. Did you mail your visitation application to this prison? Well, I have been sending some mail down there to Mahon, and so they must be deep-sixing it. And I haven't filled out a visitation thing because we got two problems. The distance of trying to visit POWs, and the fact that you wonder how much good it's going to do, and will they use it against the POW once I'm gone, because some of these guys don't understand that having their name linked to Tom Metzger is not very good for them inside the prison. There may be other guys in the prison that think it's great, but I try to protect these guys as much as I can. They moved me from the third floor housing unit to the bottom floor unit. It is so nice not to have to climb four flights of stairs 6 to 8 times a day. Well, yeah, you need the exercise, Dennis. That's why I've got stairs down into the bunker. I got to go up and down them about 10 times a day, at least. But I have, I believe, a new counselor. I must speak to him and see if you and Dan have been approved for visits. While I was at U.S. Penitentiary McCreary and FCI Pekin, both Dan and I had to contact our attorneys to write the respected wardens threatening federal litigation before Warden Holland and Warden Kruger allowed Dan to visit me. See how ridiculous and how primitive and ruthless these goddamn wardens are? I mean, even if you don't cause any problem in the prison, they do everything they can to dehumanize you. And just think of the millions. I mean, the blacks, too. I mean, in this country, this giant gulag operation. This is a bigger gulag than Russia had. There's more people in our gulag than was in the Russian gulag. To write respected wardens threatening federal litigation before Warden Holland and his Warden Kruger allowed Dan to visit me. I think they give these guys benefits and build-ups for treating prisoners shitty. You were approved to visit me at FCI Pekin, Illinois. Well, yeah, but by the time we got it set up, you were gone. The BOP still has me designed as a domestic terrorist, an SDG. Well, maybe that's a badge of honor, I don't know. Security threat group member, and a CIM. You're a real bad boy. They are filling this facility full of illegal alien mestizos and child molesters. It's a hellhole, much worse than USP McCready. I can't believe Germany and Sweden aren't having a violent revolution with hundreds of thousands of mostly single young non-white Muslims being invited to destroy the Aryan race and culture. Germany's Angela Merkel should be executed. You know, somebody sent me something the other day that said her mother was a Jew. Well, if her mother was a Jew by Jew standards, she's a Jew. So I guess we'll find out about that at some later date. Or thrown in prison for the rest of her life. Well, she should be taken to The Hague and tried as a war criminal, but you know that's not going to happen. They'll build statues to her. When will our men of our race fight back? Well, they do fight back. There's just not a lot of them fighting back. Thank you for your wonderful support of the 25 Federal Reserve notes each month. Your friend and comrade. Worse is better. Dennis Mahan, okay. And about a week ago, I had a long conversation with Dr. Scutari, and he's doing pretty good, doing fine. His parole hearing's coming up here in a month or so. I believe it might have been November. I should have wrote it down, but I sure hope he makes parole. I've been able to get some of my war papers into at least one prison. I'm not going to say on the radio show how I do it, but I'm going to start experimenting with other prisons and see what happens. I've got several hundred old war papers that got a lot of good information in them. I had a guy not long ago wanted to pay me good money and buy them all, but his reputation is not the best, and other activists had warned me about him, so he probably would have bought them and then dumped them in a dumpster. A thought to remember: in every revolution, in fact in every civil war, the victors have their way with a lot of people, and one of the groups they have their way with are people who ran the gulags and the prisons. And these people, I don't think they ever think that could happen to them, but historically, that's the thing. I mean, when they emptied the dungeons in Paris, the French Revolution, it didn't go well with the guards and the holders of the keys. And it doesn't go well for anybody else. That once a revolution starts or a civil war, the victor usually takes out his anger on those who threw people in prison. Well, that's it for today, boys and girls. Gee, that went fast. Anyhow, what I recommend is you burn CD copies of, like, the first Walter Dennis tape that I played. Burn CDs of that and throw them into places where the young people are at. But put a label on music from the some hip-hop group, some popular hip-hop group. Yeah, burn copies of Our Propaganda and then put copies of titles on from hip-hop bands. Somebody who's real popular right at the moment. And then just sail them across the fence or gates or whatever you got to do and get them into the young people's hands, no matter which side, because it has a double-edged sword. Yeah. And you might want to paste on there one of our unequal signs on the CD. That would help, too.
Declaration of War, November 25th, 1984. It is a dark and dismal time in the history of our race. An evil shadow has fallen across our once fair land. A certain vile alien people have taken control of our country.
American Bastion and the Order. Former members revealed that a Special Order assassination squad plotted to kill the heads of three commercial television networks, former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, and television producer Norman Lear, among others. The unquestioned leader of the Order was Bob Matthews, a well-liked lumberjack from upstate Washington. After more than a year of tracking Matthews, FBI agents surrounded him in an island hideout near Seattle. During a shootout on December 6, 1984, the house caught fire. When it was over, Matthews was dead. After the fire, FBI agents launched a nationwide manhunt for Matthews' followers.
In spite of Matthews' death and the arrests of his supporters, agitation persists for a militant, separate, Aryan nation. Order members say that the war has just begun.
Bob really won hell to man. And imagine a man that would die for his beliefs. There's very few men like that today.
Bruce Carroll Pierce was the FBI's most wanted man until his arrest. He was also the Order's second in command.
Just because Bob died or we've had some deaths in the past or had some setbacks, I don't believe by any means that the movement is over or that our goals will not be accomplished.
The Order was a secret army striking out at a federal government that was vulnerable to armed attack.
Government's weak. The government is pathetically weak. This government is so weak right now that if 5,000 men of any race, of any consequence, any type of philosophical fundamentalism stood up, told the federal government that we have 5,000 men who would die right now, what we believe in, government can do nothing about it.
People are surprised at what's going on, and I think it's a situation you have to report. Guys like Matthews and others declared war on what they call the Tsar, the Zionist occupational government. When that happened, you saw the Fed begin to scramble.
It was the robbery of a Brinks truck in Ukiah, California in July 1984 when the Order made off with $3.6 million that drew the FBI's full attention. At the same time, Secret Service agents caught several members trying to pass counterfeit bills. After his arrest, a friend became a government informant.
I believe that those men are prisoners of war, and I would support them as prisoners of war.
Tom Metzger is one of the most popular leaders on the ultra-right. While media attention was fixed on the trial of Order members in Seattle, from his home and headquarters in Fallbrook, California, an hour's drive from San Diego, Metzger continued to recruit for his organization, WAR.
This is a time of rapid communication, and we must be on the cutting edge of technology like anyone else. We like it because it reaches into maybe every home in the United States where there's a computer. Every young person that is into computers, and there are millions across the United States, and they tend to be sharp kids with these computers in their bedroom, and they can log on and get all this information.
To attract others to his program, Metzger also set up 24-hour telephone hotlines in 8 cities, including Los Angeles, Sacramento, and San Francisco.
Why are the Jews and their supporters so afraid of free speech if they try to terrorize their critics into silence?
Metzger also has a television talk show aired on Community Access Cable Television.
Reason that show dedicated to free speech.
When FBI agents moved in on the Order, members were within a few weeks of cracking Brink Central Vault here in San Francisco. With more than $30 million, they could have bought and outfitted an army.
I need my own state. I need my own nation. I need to have my own schools for my daughter, for my son, for my family.
When Nero tried to persecute the Christians in the Roman times, it did not eradicate them. And I do not believe it will eradicate us.
Just a few will be enough to reignite the spark for us to rise again. It's not over by any means. It's just the start.
We enjoin all people to choose intelligently which side they will be on. Make sure that you have the greatest number of relevant facts possible. There will surely come a day when bench sitting will be impossible. And once you have made up your mind and begin to act, the die